This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Efficiency Paradox, What Big Data Can't Do, by Edward Tenner. Read for you by Jason Culp. To the memory of William H. McNeil. Preface. The Seven Deadly Sins of Efficiency. Why, it is still a work in progress. This book is a critique of something self-evidently desirable, even wonderful, until it isn't, efficiency. And it's also about an apparent oxymoron that seems absurd until we realize that it's also been essential, inspired inefficiency. Efficiency is mostly good, but like all good things, can be carried too far. Even an excess of water can be lethal. More than 20 years ago, at the dawn of the web as we know it, when I wrote my first book on the unintended consequences of technology, Why Things Bite Back, published in 1996, the idea of efficiency itself as a threat hardly occurred to me. In fact, far from allying with the critics who called themselves neo-Luddites, a term now shared by their friends and foes, I was an early adopter and enthusiast. As a science book editor, recruiting authors globally and affiliated with a university offering email, I had already been using it to correspond and set up appointments. As a researcher already using electronic databases, I found the new web browser and graphic interface a welcome improvement. As a writer, always tinkering with my text, I had embraced word processing since the days of the TRS-80 in the early Reagan era. Remembering the tedium of retyping and the mess of carbon paper, I felt and feel no nostalgia for my own typewriting, though I do find that the typewritten letter has a distinctive graphic personality through the bite of letters in the paper and the varying impressions created by carbon ribbons from saturated to faint. I saw and wrote about the downside of new technology, the chronic back pain and carpal tunnel ailments resulting from the ever more sedentary office, and the comical fate of the paperless office. But I shared in much of the technological optimism of the later 1990s. The web at first appeared a godsend for newspapers and magazines. Whether or not electronic publication ever replaced print, their publishers reasoned, they held a priceless franchise in high-quality content that attracted an affluent readership coveted by advertisers. Technology itself was a profitable advertising focus into the early 21st century. I occasionally find the thick circuits section of the New York Times among my clippings, well sponsored by hardware and software publishers and electronics retailers. The efficiency of the electronic newsroom helped make all this possible. It seemed that society could have its cake and eat it too. Amazon appeared, but it could coexist with still profitable chains of giant bookstores. It was hard to imagine that Amazon threatened Borders and Barnes & Noble, as these had decimated independent bookstores in the 1980s with crushing scale and an earlier generation of technology. The rise of robotics did not seem to threaten employment levels. Old-line business magazines shared still-thriving newsstands with technology-oriented newcomers like Wired and the Industry Standard. Technological utopian authors spread the gospel of individual empowerment while corporate elites made more money than ever. If the 1960s were the go-go years, the 1990s were the win-win decade thanks to the efficiency of the web. Beginning around 2005, the new hyper-efficient world entered a different phase. With the introduction of the Apple iPhone in 2007, made possible by the rapid evolution of computer processing speed, electronic devices were gradually ceasing to be tools that people used and put away and becoming extensions of themselves and their personal and professional networks. At the same time, the exceptionally efficient search engine Google and the social networking site Facebook, together with Amazon, were transforming online commerce by adding a new level to the Internet, the platform, between the corporate website and the open web. Since 2008, the dream of utopia through ever-increasing electronic efficiency has been dimmed. The recession that began that year had many origins, but was due in part to the technical ease with which bankers and securities industry professionals were able to manage risk. Meanwhile, the rate of increase of the number of transistors that can fit on a computer chip has been slowing down. It used to double every 18 months or so, a rhythm described since 1965 as Moore's Law, after Gordon Moore, a founder of the dominant chip manufacturer Intel, but since 2005 has been stretched to 2 to 3 years. Further, the success of new platforms in attracting advertisers and marketers has come at the expense of the revenue of newspapers and magazines. The all-time peak in advertising revenues did not occur until 10 years after the advent of the web in 2005, when it was $47.4 billion in print and $2 billion in digital. In 2014, these numbers were $16.4 billion and $3.5 billion, respectively. There were, of course, many winners as well as losers in the new hyper-efficient web, in which computer techniques, algorithms, were supplanting intuitive judgment. And there were benefits to web-savvy consumers from increased price competition. But for many economists, the hope was dimming that the benefits of more efficient production and distribution would lift the public's standard of living. Two noted economists, Tyler Cowen in The Great Stagnation, 2011, and Robert J. Gordon in The Rise and Fall of American Growth, 2016, even advanced the previously heretical idea that the 20th century had seen the last of an era of low-hanging fruit, transformative innovations that by today's standards were relatively cheap to develop. This is a sharp turn from the mood even at the beginning of the 2008 recession, when the computer scientist and futurist Ray Kurzweil repeated his prediction from 2000 that a computer with the hardware to emulate a human brain would be available for $1,000 by the year 2020. Not only some economists, but many citizens of Western countries have lost faith in the ability of industrial and academic elites to deliver the benefits of technological efficiency to either the middle class or the poor. Unless the trend reverses, politics around the world are likely to remain unsettled for years to come, no matter which parties hold power. So, it is time to consider whether too much efficiency is part of the problem. I will suggest that we need not abandon the idea of efficiency, but cultivate inefficient behavior that in the long run will make technology not only more effective, getting more done, but more efficient, doing it with fewer resources. First, we need a definition of efficiency. Economists use the term technically in a way that I could not follow here without making this a different book. I would define it as producing goods, providing services or information, or processing transactions with a minimum of waste. The word came into wide use in the 19th century, when scientists and engineers extended to human labor the physical idea of efficiency as useful work per unit of energy. Social scientists from the 1890s through the 1920s, in turn, expanded this sense to all inputs and outputs in society, and indeed to an ideal of social efficiency, the rational optimization of human welfare. Innocent as the phrase sounds today, at the turn of the century, it was rooted as much in racism and xenophobia as in technological idealism. Its prophet, the sociologist Edward A. Ross, was forced to leave Stanford University for his anti-Asian pronouncements in 1900. In his book, Social Control, published the following year, he combined admiration for the restless, striving, doing Arian with his personal ambition, his lust for power, his longing to wreak himself, his willingness to turn the world upside down to get the fame or the fortune or the woman he wants, with fear that this Faustian individualism would ruin society if left unchecked. As a nativist progressive, Ross looked to the schools to use the methods of industrial work rationalization to indoctrinate a new generation in the ethics of good government. That ideology of efficiency has long vanished, but the goal of achieving more with less effort still thrives. I would apply the word efficiency to all technology intended to reduce human time needed for a task, whether buying a product, learning a subject, planning a trip, or making a medical decision. The economist Robert Solow remarked over 30 years ago, in 1987, that computers had become ubiquitous everywhere but in productivity statistics. Today, we see the benefits of algorithmic efficiency everywhere, except in real personal income statistics. I take no position on the future, whether we are doomed to stasis and growing inequality, or whether some new super-efficient technology will make today's concerns seem like the pessimism of many economists of the 1930s. When in reality, the technological foundations of the post-war boom were laid in antibiotics, detergents, plastics, and ultimately personal computing itself. If any generalization is possible about technological forecasting, it is that many of the projected revolutions are stillborn, while other, often originally more obscure innovations, transform society. Science fiction is no exception. Jules Verne's publisher considered his most accurate vision of the future, Paris in the 20th century, unbelievable. Verne agreed, and it was not issued until the 1990s. There are many other caveats regarding efficiency that are not part of this book because others have noted them so ably. One is environmental. Conservative and libertarian economists questioning mandatory energy efficiency targets cite what is called a rebound effect, in which the savings from a more efficient technology are offset or even completely annulled by increased consumption. This pattern was first noticed in British coal consumption in the 1860s by the economist William Stanley Jevons, and has reappeared with each new energy-saving innovation. Reduced energy costs often have led to purchase of sport utility vehicles and McMansions. More efficient air conditioning technology has meant that units are installed in more rooms or replaced by central whole-house air conditioning systems. This effect is far from an iron law. Even one of its leading proponents, Robert J. Michels, acknowledges that mandatory efficiency standards for refrigerators have created no apparent rebound. But there is no doubt the effect is real, and the efficiency of technology from LED lighting to electric cars is also offset by environmental damage from rare earth mining to electronic waste. Next after energy are critiques of agricultural efficiency, usually from the left. In output per farmer and farm employer, mechanized conventional agriculture has been outstanding. Yet Swedish agricultural scientists, painstakingly adding up energy inputs and outputs, recently were able to show that a tractor needs 67% more energy than the feed required for a draft horse tilling the same field. The tractor is far more effective than the horse. It will produce almost 2.5 times the food from the same area that the animal's ancestor did in the 1920s, but it needs 13 times as much energy. And there are other objections to our conventional agriculture. Efficiency of breeding plants and animals for rapid harvesting and slaughter, respectively, has often damaged nutritional value and taste. Only recently has the heirloom tomato begun to make a comeback. Pigs and chickens raised for efficient production may suffer health problems. Bovine growth hormone, while natural and safe for human consumption, induces a level of milk production that can be painful to cows. And the quest for efficiency can encourage a potentially disastrous monoculture, such as the lumper potato that dominated pre-famine Irish agriculture. Since almost all potatoes in Ireland and much of the rest of Europe were genetically identical, a blight originating in the New World devastated the 1845 harvest. Monoculture, as the writer Michael Pollan put it in The Botany of Desire, is where the logic of nature collides with the logic of economics. Which logic will ultimately prevail can never be in doubt. On a global level, true efficiency has always been difficult to calculate, especially since some means to efficiency, fertilizers and pesticides, can reduce the Earth's overall productivity by harming fish in runoff and by endangering pollinators, respectively. In fact, our entire industrial civilization has been threatening its own efficiency through carbon emissions. If efficiency is defined broadly, a book on its paradoxes would become a study of everything. It would be returning to ecological economics of the Romanian-American scholar Nicolas Georgescu Rogan, who saw the decline of order in the world, the increase of entropy, as the inevitable consequence of human attempts to defy it. Climate change has helped to revive interest in Georgescu's ideas, but I leave assessments of their validity to others. Even Silicon Valley culture, which rejects such theoretical limits and tends to regard space exploration as the solution to all earthly resource constraints, recognizes the environmental, health, cultural, and ethical costs of too much efficiency. For all their smart houses, web-connected appliances, and self-monitoring devices, the acolytes of efficiency know how to draw the line. From organic heirloom produce to, as we will hear in Chapter 3, technology-free Rudolf Steiner elementary schools, the fruits of artisanal values attract many otherwise high-tech families. Inefficiency in the form of labor-intensive goods and services has a place in their society as a signifier of authenticity and privilege. This new upper stratum seems to have little in common with the robber baron society described by Thorstein Veblen in his 1899 tract, The Theory of the Leisure Class. The patriarchal and often racist values of the Gilded Age plutocracy may not have vanished entirely, but they are considered worse than immoral now. They are unfashionable. So is the old ideal of cultivated ease as embodied in palaces like the Frick Collection and the Morgan Library, a pose already obsolete as early as 1970, when the economist Stefan Linder published his pathbreaking The Harried Leisure Class. Today's technology multimillionaires are more likely to be scouting for the next startup than to be enjoying the cash from their last venture in early retirement. Yet, as in Veblen's day, ostentatious inefficiency has its privileges. As the technology journalist Dave Rosenberg noted in 2013 on the San Francisco Chronicle website, luxury goods, especially watches, are part of a subtle push in Silicon Valley toward quality-crafted tools, clothing, and accessories. While the general population looks forward to the latest in futuristic status symbols, tech's futurists are going retro. The same can be said of other labor-intensive tools, such as hand-forged chef's knives. The private traditionalism of technologists may be seen as admirable pragmatism and open-mindedness, and a force for more employment amid growing automation. It can also be seen as a cynical endorsement of a two-tier society, mediocrity for the masses, luxurious heritage for creative innovators. There have always been extremes, but the market for good middle-range products has declined. There is room for Bloomingdale's and Walmart, but the classic middle-class department store, Gimbel's, closed its doors in 1986, and its former rivals are struggling. This points up yet another criticism of technological efficiency. a tendency, according to some economists, to amplify inequality and thus to endanger civic life and even democracy itself. Arthur M. Oaken's Equality and Efficiency, The Big Trade-Off, is still debated among economists 40 years after its publication and was reissued by the Brookings Institution in 2015. It's possible to imagine a society that is both highly efficient and unstable. The Silicon Valley cult of disruption may have originally suggested turning power from oligarchs to the people, but now it can also mean the creation of a new oligarchy that appears even harder to dislodge. In Silicon Valley itself, the increase in house prices and apartment rent has borne out the analysis of the economist Fred Hirsch, who in the 1970s foresaw that even if efficiency and productivity continued to rise, there was a positional economy of goods that could never, like information technology products, become affordable to the masses, like good tickets to a hit play or apartments in global economic hubs, both of which are what Hirsch called positional goods. Even so, the rising importance of and frustration engendered by positional goods is not, I believe, the best argument against efficiency. Technological enthusiasts have countered that even if the gap grows and billionaires capture more of the world's output, the planet's people are still better off and might not be if there were no incentive to take risks and fail, as most ventures do. Silicon Valley depends on an inefficient and wasteful startup culture to create a more efficient society in the end, in this view. Electronic efficiency has more serious problems. On a technical level, there is still no answer to the challenge of security and the threat of hacking. If fear of electronic transactions reaches a critical level, there may yet be a backlash against web commerce. But so far, it has been so profitable for banks and credit card companies that they have been able to absorb at least some varieties of fraud as a cost of doing business. Likewise, the 1990s dream of participatory democracy has at least been stalled by fringe groups' ability to use websites and social media. But defenders of electronic democracy can always point to promising new initiatives. The technology critic Evgeny Morozov rightly observes that inefficiency can be good if it results from deliberative commitment by a democratically run community, taking a stand against the inhumanity of Taylorism, regimentation of work methods, and market fundamentalism. But that does not prevent market fundamentalists from securing democratic consent for hyper-efficiency. Likewise, algorithms can both intentionally and unintentionally discriminate against individuals by gender, race, geography, or socioeconomic status. But defenders can reply that offending programs can be made fairer and thus even more efficient. Algorithms and the staggering data they gather on our spending, travel, investments, credit, and political views, or at least those of our friends, threaten the privacy of Americans every day, and some people have begun opting out of online life. But so far there has not been enough damage from either identity theft or intrusive marketing to change Americans' behavior radically. Yet another critique of the efficiency of mobile technology aims at its damage to human relationships, whether commercial or personal. But Americans at least have always been unsentimental about the first, forsaking local merchants for big-box retailers even before the rise of electronic commerce. And while many people, especially parents of young children and teenagers, have reservations about the effects of social media on concentration and human relationships, abrasiveness remains a feature rather than a bug in much of Silicon Valley culture. To the enthusiasts of efficiency in and out of Silicon Valley, such objections are only temporary issues for technical resolution in the next round of algorithms. Mass unemployment from robotics is still only a disputed hypothesis, and robotics advocates can point to the failure of previous doomsaying. Efficiency remains a core American value, and while Silicon Valley billionaires now face more skeptical scrutiny, they have not lost their mantle of being successors of Thomas Edison, John D. Rockefeller, and Henry Ford as builders of American culture. Steve Jobs, ruthless like all of them at times, still was widely mourned by millions who believed he had enhanced their lives. This book offers a different critique of technological efficiency, one that accepts the goal of reducing waste in the use of human time and natural resources, but recognizes that a single-minded drive for a friction-free world, as Bill Gates and his co-authors put it in 1995, can actually reduce efficiency. Instead of examining all the social, political, and ethical challenges of information technology, it focuses on its long-term self-subversion. We know that the obsession with childhood hygiene, so popular since the early 20th century, can weaken the immune system. We know that overprescription of antibiotics can foster superbugs, that liberal use of opioids can reduce their effectiveness and encourage addiction, and that habitual reliance on sleeping pills can worsen insomnia. Few of us renounce medicine or pharmaceuticals, but we have a new respect for natural equilibria. Questioning efficiency must now go beyond the familiar distinction between efficiency and effectiveness. War is extremely inefficient when the number of bullets or shells needed to defeat the enemy is considered, but since defeat can be catastrophic, all that inefficiency can be effective. Conversely, clean diesel automotive engines are highly efficient in fuel consumption, but because their emissions are difficult to control, they can no longer be considered effective. Algorithms, the programming techniques that multiply the power of computer hardware, present a different set of problems. Most of the time, they are highly effective, as well as efficient. For example, public key cryptography takes advantage of the difficulty of factoring very large numbers to make electronic financial transactions secure and internet communications generally secure, despite many successful attacks. But other algorithms may risk not only effectiveness but efficiency itself in the long run. That is, they can lead not just to undesirable consequences, but to wasted efforts and missed opportunities. They fall into 7 groups. Counter-serendipity. Most chance events are adverse or neutral. Efficiency makes the world more predictable. But if everything is as direct as possible, we are also deprived of the benefits of occasional randomization and of productive mistakes. Conventional algorithms reduce negative surprises at the high price of threatening positive ones. The two are inseparable. Hyperfocus. Efficiency is often expressed as focus, which up to a point is excellent and necessary. But evolution has given us and other animals a second kind of sight, peripheral vision, which is less sensitive to details but allows us to see large patterns and motion. Early in the history of astronomy, it was understood that faint objects could be seen better by looking slightly away, averted vision. As Edgar Allan Poe wrote in The Murders in the Rue Morgue, "To look at a star by glances, to view it in a sidelong way by turning toward it the exterior portions of the retina, more susceptible of feeble impressions of light than the interior, is to behold the star distinctly." Efficiency, indispensable in everyday operations, makes it harder to pull back for the big picture. Self-amplifying cascades. Intentionally or not, algorithms may fail to select the most optimal choice by amplifying initially small effects. Their early decisions can become self-fulfilling prophecies. This is a special risk in automated processes, from financial trading to self-driving vehicles, in which multiple algorithms, none of which can be flawless, are turned loose to interact, sometimes without the possibility of quick human intervention. Skill erosion. Automated systems perform most tasks better than most people most of the time. They are nearly always more efficient and consistent, which is why they have been so popular, and rightly so. The partnership of a skilled person and an electronic system in principle delivers better performance than either alone. But there can be severe problems when the robotic partner fails. If the human, whether physician, airline pilot, or everyday motorist, has not maintained skills, the result can be catastrophic for the efficiency of the whole system. Perverse feedback. The interaction of automated systems becomes even more problematic when they are called upon not only to execute human goals, but to provide incentives. It's possible to satisfy a criterion, like a test score, through means that frustrate the real desired outcome, actual understanding. In social science, this is known as Campbell's Law. Data deluge. Huge data sets, when used by skilled people with a deep understanding of underlying processes, may increase efficiency. But their use can also threaten efficiency itself. The volume of automatically acquired data in many fields is increasing more rapidly than the per terabyte cost of storage, increasing expenses. Big data can also suggest false positives and erroneous hypotheses that take expensive person hours to evaluate and rule out, leading, especially in healthcare, to alarm and alert fatigue. The net result may be less real efficiency. Monoculture. Without careful design, an algorithm can multiply a successful formula to the point that a system becomes less responsive to changing circumstances. Social psychologists acknowledge, for example, that some of their experiments cannot be replicated, not because of any error in the original design, analysis, or data collection, but because societies and their values change. Life scientists' mice are genetically standardized, but people live in a constantly evolving technological environment and adjust their behavior constantly and often unconsciously. To write about information technology is to shoot at a target that appears to be not only moving but accelerating. And one of the greatest challenges is that there are so many other books addressing the same issues. As I'll suggest in Chapter 2, far from killing the publication of printed books, network technology has helped strengthen them. One of the favorite topics on the web is the web itself. In May 2017, a Wikipedia category article listed 49 pages of books about the Internet, and a number of major new works had not yet been included. Amazon.com listed over 24,000 books on internet and social media alone. It is a striking illustration of the information abundance that will be discussed in that chapter. While many of these books are technical monographs or college texts, and others are reports on primary research on economic and social statistics, databases, or experiments with human subjects, others, like this one, are interpretations. There are so many that overlapping studies citing similar evidence may appear in the same season. Parallel ideas and mutual influence are inevitable. This crowding is hardly new. Literary theorists have long expounded on intertextuality, while as early as 1898, the fiction writer Arnold Bennett, in his autobiographical novel A Man from the North, more vividly portrayed the majestic British Museum round reading room as a cannibal feast of the living upon the dead, served by attendants off rolling book trucks. So it seems to be almost 125 years later. I thus should situate this book. It is obviously not in the cornucopian genre of Kevin Kelly's What Technology Wants, or Ray Kurzweil's The Singularity Is Near. But technological optimism is, on balance, a blessing. Given the dismal failure rate of innovation, even unrealistic hopes help raise money for potentially beneficial inventions. Hype can be good for society if not always for the average individual investor or consumer. At the other extreme are the works of technological Cassandras such as Superintelligence by the Oxford philosopher Nick Bostrom. Joyful and fearful prophecies actually have much in common. They both foresee a transformed humanity and disagree only as to whether it will be paradise or inferno. The efficiency paradox is part of a great middle range by authors skeptical of technological utopianism, but not necessarily alarmed by the likelihood of meltdown. A half dozen are especially worth discussing. The most thoroughgoing nemesis of Silicon Valley is Evgeny Morozov, who combines polemical verve with impressive documentation. Morozov's early years in Soviet-era Belarus inform his rejection of planners' arrogance. Having grown up in an ideology-saturated society, he has a keen eye for the cant of the Western information technology industry and its admirers as well. His book, To Save Everything, Click Here, is a critique of what he calls, adopting a concept from architecture critics, solutionism. The idea that human problems have purely technological remedies, a pursuit of efficiency that ignores serious social, political, and ethical consequences, and unjustifiably equates innovation with improvement. He might equally have called it neo-efficiency. Inefficiency, ambiguity, and opacity, whether in politics or in everyday life, that the newly empowered geeks and solutionists are rallying against, are not in any sense problematic, Morozov observes. Quite the opposite. These vices are often virtues in disguise. In fact, he argues against the very existence of the Internet, as opposed to the agendas of powerful organizations exploiting networked resources. At the same time, he scoffs at what he considers futile attempts by web critics like Eli Pariser, The Filter Bubble, and Ethan Zuckerman, Rewire, to promote their own progressive solutions. More efficient communication has not and will not resolve social, political, and ethical questions. In Morozov's terms, I am probably a techno-structuralist, one less interested in the direct, anticipated, and desirable consequences of innovation, and more interested in the indirect, unanticipated, and undesirable ones. Yet I part ways with Morozov's post-internet viewpoint and cite what sociologists call the Thomas Theorem, proposed by William Isaac and Dorothy Swain Thomas. If people believe something is real, it becomes so in its consequences. To take a mundane example, false news about gasoline shortages sometimes creates real gasoline shortages as panicking drivers top up their fuel tanks more often. The Internet, as opposed to the maneuverings of those who control influential websites, may be a myth, but if enough people accept, for example, the neutrality of Google and Facebook algorithms, it is a reality. Since web-based commerce and publishing won't go away, and since they have had positive as well as negative results, I believe in accepting this situation as a fact and finding new ways to blend the intuitive and algorithmic, the analog and the digital. That is obvious. To his credit, Morozov is not afraid of negativity, just as I am not afraid of obviousness. I recall the lecture hall remark of one of my undergraduate teachers, the historian of science Charles C. Gillespie. There is nothing more embarrassing to the educated mind than a true cliché. Like To Save Everything, Nicholas Carr's The Glass Cage, How Our Computers Are Changing Us, identifies efficiency as the core of both its values and its strategy, dogged, almost monomaniacal in the case of Google. It also correctly highlights the dangers of allowing over-reliance on algorithms to erode human skills, a theme that Carr presented forcefully in his earlier book, The Shallows. From similar facts and studies, this book draws different conclusions. Carr is a disillusioned information technologist. I am a historian by background. In the late 1970s and 1980s, I found that first word processing and then electronic library resources helped me to return to a writing career that had been interrupted. Because I already had an excellent education in research, information technology turned out to be a multiplier. Pessimism about the effects of technology is a distraction from the real need for education and self-education on the best way to combine algorithms and intuition, digital and analog. The Glass Cage elaborates a point that I believe was first made by the technology curator James Blackaby, that we lose something when we shift from tool use, the pre-modern woodworker's shaving bench, to tool management, the workbench, a 19th century innovation. Blackaby showed how the slide rule required engineers to be more directly involved in their calculations than did the electronic devices that replaced it decades ago. A point also made more recently by the engineer and historian of technology, Henry Petrosky. Without calling for a return to 18th century agriculture, Carr praises the unity of body and tool in the operation of the scythe, citing a sonnet of Robert Frost. Carr is not alone. Hand mowing is a flourishing niche hobby. Thanks to modern search engines, the would-be mower can choose scythes from Austria, Italy, Denmark, and Australia. He or she can also find other literary evocations of hand tools, like the Tolstoy-quoting New York Times op-ed piece, The Russian Peasant's Workout, which makes one want to find a meadow and swing away. Inspired by this style of human-tool relationship, Carr scorns Morozov's allegedly simplistic idea of technology as a mere means to liberate us from toil. Is that payback for Morozov's remark about Carr's McLuhan-esque medium-centrism? But I suspect it must have been much less satisfying to pre-modern peasants to be swinging and sharpening those blades for their livelihoods from dawn to dusk during harvest season than it was to more recent poets and novelists. Pieter Bruegel's The Elder's Paintings and Prints, with their images of muscular prowess, fatigue, and thirst, are stylized, but may also be more historically accurate. So I cannot agree that our age necessarily has more aimlessness and gloom than previous decades or centuries, or conversely find it one of joy and fulfillment just because it is easier to join a hand-mowing club. Instead, I agree with Norbert Wiener in believing that if properly used, information technology can spare us mind-numbing routine and free our time for more creative activity. There was an intimate relationship between tool, hand, and mind in the quill pen, and it may have enforced deliberate writing of so many literary classics, but I am glad I never needed to sharpen one. Kathy O'Neill's Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy, offers another important caveat from an information technology professional. Unlike most technology critics, O'Neill has been on the forefront of the systems that alarm her, the use of algorithms to target vulnerable people, whether in workplace wellness programs, in for-profit higher education sales, or in the justice system. The cynicism that she reveals makes her book the work on the ethics of big data and algorithms most widely reviewed online to date. But as in medicine, therapy is more challenging than diagnosis. Her proposal for audits of artificial intelligence systems raises questions. First, many other theorists and technical experts now believe that with machine learning, artificial intelligence can no longer be understood in the way that the source code of conventional programs can be studied. It is not clear that even if the initial code is freely available online, the ultimate behavior of the program, after assimilating vast quantities of new data, is humanly understandable. If these specialists are right, Rationality, carried far enough, creates a black box machine impenetrable to human reason and thus to auditing. Second, even if the software and its implicit biases are understandable, financial auditing is a discouraging precedent. Who can forget the collapse of Arthur Andersen following the Enron scandal, and the failure of other giant accounting and bond rating firms to question the practices leading to the 2008 recession? Seeking objectivity, judges protect forensic science and sentencing software from disclosure and effective challenge. In such cases, potentially biased algorithms may annul the right to confront witnesses and rebut government evidence. The legal scholar Frank Pasquale's The Black Box Society preceded Weapons of Math Destruction and remains the best account of the challenges facing legislators and regulators from the power of secret algorithms. Pasquale recommends the European approach to regulating big data, and I agree that we can learn from it. But well-intentioned privacy laws are a two-edged sword. The right to be forgotten, enshrined in European Union legislation, may have been motivated by a desire to remove the shadow of youthful indiscretions from search engine results. But laws protecting the powerless may also shield the privileged. The London Daily Telegraph published summaries of stories deleted after objections brought by their subjects, including a physician, a military officer, and a cleric involved in sexual abuse cases. Of course, press reports may be unfair or inaccurate, but erasing published information is an alarming precedent. Pasquale's book and O'Neill's complement each other in demystifying Silicon Valley's claims. Their concern is with effects on society. O'Neill, in particular, is impressed with how well today's algorithms work, which makes them all the more dangerous. My own emphasis is on why the short-run efficiency of algorithms can impede rather than stimulate innovation. David Sachs's The Revenge of Analog documents persuasively that older media and experiences, from chemical film to mechanical watches and retail stores, have been remarkably resilient, meeting human needs that digital life cannot fulfill. It's a vivid account of the continued relevance of tactile, concrete experience and of Silicon Valley's recognition of it, from the flourishing of Apple stores since their introduction by Steve Jobs in 2001 to the revival of Moleskine notebooks. It is also one of the best expressions of the grounds for optimism about the coexistence of algorithms and human intuition, a theme that also underlies this book. But since the appearance of Apple stores, clouds have returned to the horizon. For example, from the inauguration of the stores to spring 2017, employment in American department stores had shrunk by a third. There are still physical niche markets, but none of the historic major chains except Walmart has the resources to compete with Amazon. Two great chains that had weathered over a century of recurring depressions and recessions, Sears and Macy's, were struggling in 2017. Amazon's own retail ventures are unlikely to match the tempting exhilaration of experimenting with rows of Apple devices and of receiving personal support and repair service on the spot. New owners of Polaroid patents may have revived instant photography, and Kodak has announced it is bringing back Ektachrome color slide film, but Kodachrome is probably extinct forever. Production of 35mm motion picture film continues, yet it depends tenuously on the leverage that a small number of star directors wield with studios and exhibitors. Messy, by the economist and writer Tim Harford, arrived in 2016 as a welcome corrective to a business self-help genre dominated ever since Benjamin Franklin by organization and system and admonitions to methodical habits. No wonder a transatlantic public, weary of management jargon, rejoiced at the idea of sweet disorder. It makes an excellent case that disorganization can be creative, even if it falls into a counter-genre of its own, including Catherine Schulz's Being Wrong and Harford's earlier volume, Adapt. Yet like most other business gurus, Harford undervalues luck. Drawing on a study by the Nobel laureate economist Paul Samuelson from the 1980s, and on more recent research on rewards for investments and management, the finance economist Moshe Levy has argued that most of the superior returns attributed to talent can be explained by luck. Narratives of success, like Harford's, reflect survivorship bias, the use of striking examples without consideration of how many other people sharing the same traits, experiences, or strategies were unsuccessful. As on Wall Street, a style performing brilliantly in one market environment may be a flop in another. When contemplating Silicon Valley's big winners, Amazon's CEO Jeff Bezos is featured in Messy, we can retrospectively find brilliant strategies. Yet we also find potentially fatal crises. Messy behavior that wins contests may be maladaptive in power. Harford was bold enough to praise Donald Trump's improvised oratorical style, yet what made Trump a successful campaigner appeared to be failing to win broad approval in the first year of his presidency. Of course, Bill Clinton, another notoriously disorganized chief executive, was re-elected, survived scandal and impeachment, and is still remembered nostalgically by millions. So, Harford may yet be right. Nevertheless, critics have also noted that messiness contributed to the mixed record of the Clinton presidency. At its best, Messy illustrates the principle the sociologist Charles Tilly called the invisible elbow, that apparently planned accomplishments are actually the products of a cascade of contingencies. But messiness falls short as a watchword. First, literal messiness is costly. There may not be a truly scientific estimate of the hours lost in looking for misplaced objects and documents. Studies seem to be funded by companies selling solutions for tracking keys and business records. But most of us have found that messiness can take precious time from creativity. Second, at least one of the people Harford characterizes as messy, Charles Darwin, may have pursued multiple research projects at once. But Darwin was a careful and organized worker who ran his investigations as a family enterprise. In the Cambridge University Natural History Museum, his labels are still highly regarded. Third, corporate management doesn't really believe in messiness for the great majority of employees. Conformity prevails. Efficient performance monitoring software denies creative mistakes to most of the rank-and-file workforce, whether white or blue-collar. Messiness may thus be just another status marker, a privilege of the post-leisure overclass. Elites, researchers have suggested, use non-conforming behavior, like the Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg's hoodie, to signal their immunity to the masses' norms, the so-called red sneakers effect. And no wonder, since Harford's employer, the London-based Financial Times newspaper, described its readership in May 2017 as the world's most desirable audience, with the largest purchasing power and highest net worth. In other words, if you're not already in the 1%, don't try this at home. Two other books appeared as The Efficiency Paradox was about to go to press. Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy, by Jonathan Taplin, a media studies academic and former music tour manager and film producer. And the even more ominously titled World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech, by Franklin Foer, a writer and former editor of The New Republic. I did not have a chance to read either carefully enough to deal with their arguments, though I agree, using similar statistics, that the platform economy has done economic damage to many writers, artists, composers, and musicians. I am one of them. The Wilson Quarterly, American Heritage of Invention and Technology, Civilization, and other magazines to which I contributed are no longer publishing. I also agree with what I have read of Foer's analysis of the harm that pursuit of digital efficiency and the pursuit of clicks can do to quality. The control of an increasing share of advertising by Facebook, in particular, is a serious problem. I can make only two preliminary comments now regarding both titles. First, the present book covers a greater range of professions than the media and the arts, and the positive as well as negative consequences of the rise of mobile computing, apps, and big data. Second, for all their hundreds of billions of dollars in assets and their theoretical influence on decision-making, the moguls were unable in 2016 to prevent the election of a presidential candidate whose positions on climate change, immigration, diversity, and marriage equality, among other issues, most of them deplore. An essay on the pro-Trump site Breitbart has endorsed the breakup of Google. Democracy, or at least electoral college majority, may be threatening Silicon Valley more than vice versa. The efficiency paradox links two eras of the pursuit of efficiency. The first began in the late 18th century and continued through most of the 20th. It substituted continuous processes for discrete production and gave us the classic image of the wheels of industry, rolls of paper, spools of thread, ribbons of steel, the classic assembly line of films like Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times. Of course, such industries represented only part of even industrial nations' output, but the ideal of the continuous process inspired capitalists and socialists alike. Continuous production may still be going strong, in fact, stronger than ever, thanks to industrial robots, but it has lost the excitement of the early and middle 20th century. The platform company, which uses software to bring together buyers and sellers of goods and services, represents a new kind of efficiency, based less on the organization of machines and human labor than on the gathering, analysis, and exchange of data. The platform era that began in the late 1990s with Amazon.com entered a new phase in the 21st century with the rise of search engines, smartphones, social media, networked web-based software, and a revival of artificial intelligence from the doldrums of the early 1990s. I am looking at four sides of the new efficiency and asking why, for all its convenience, its benefits to most people have been elusive: media and culture, education, transportation, and medicine. My conclusion is that we don't have to choose between big data, algorithms, and efficiency on one side, and intuition, skill, and experience on the other. We need the right blend. I will present a set of strategies for achieving it. The problem of platform efficiency, I will suggest in the first chapter, is that it promotes what the originator of the concept of disruptive innovation, Clayton Christensen, calls business process innovation. It reduces transaction costs by matching buyers and sellers with automated software. The social benefits are real but limited. Platform companies can promote competition and benefit consumers by holding inflation in check. The risks are also real and have been well documented by critics: loss of consumer privacy, sometimes unconscionable boilerplate in terms of service agreements. Ancestry.com's contract claims broad ownership rights to customers' DNA data, current oligopoly, and potential monopoly. Less commonly noted is another consequence of Wall Street's romance with platform-based efficiency. It has diverted capital and talent from riskier, but ultimately more broadly beneficial, market-creating innovation. 19th century continuous process innovations did not just reduce friction. In eliminating some jobs, they created many others, often more skilled and highly paid. Some economists believe that this phase of technology was a one-time event that will never be repeated. Yet there is reason to doubt any pronouncement about the future based on extrapolation from the recent record. The second chapter turns to the revolution made possible by the most powerful algorithm of all, Google.